Found on all continents except Antarctica, the peregrine falcon is a fast-flying raptor that can reach an impressive 200 miles per hour while diving or swooping down on its prey. Even at other times, the peregrine maintains impressive speeds, averaging 30 miles per hour while flying and up to 70 miles per hour when directly pursuing its prey. It's no wonder that for thousands of years, falconers trained these birds for hunting purposes. Two places on the central coast where I often see a peregrine is at Yaquinahead on the rocks out beyond the lighthouse, and at Hasitahead at the very top by the lighthouse, off the very northwest corner of the fence. There is also a pair of peregrines that nest each year at Yaquinahead on the cliffs above the visitor center, giving local photographers and bird watchers a thrill each season. The peregrine may be an aggressive hunter, but it has its own predators, including golden eagles, great horned owls, and believe it or not, other peregrine falcons. Missed a show recently? You can find all of our shows on SoundCloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door, Oregon, and look for The Wave. Have an idea for a show you would like to hear? Email me at dina@kxcr.net to share your idea. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations KBOO, KCEI, Pacific Northwest Radio, and KXCR for airing Beyond Your Front Door. Thanks to Oregon-based Jump in the Rails for performing the song Smith Chapel used on this show. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 10 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with
Jacqueline Keeler, your host for this most recent episode, this latest episode of American Standoff. And we are a fairly new KBOO show. We started on January 6, 2022, a year on the anniversary of the Capitol insurrection. And so we're a show that covers the current political divide in America from an Indigenous perspective, given by myself, Jacqueline Keeler, a Native journalist based here in Oregon. And I always start by reminding everyone that over a year ago, on January 6, 2021, I guess it's going on a year and over a year and 8 months, maybe a year, and thousands of supporters of former President Trump gathered in D.C. and later stormed the Capitol, contesting President Biden's election. And also on December 21st, 2020, just a few weeks before that, Oregonians had already seen our state capitol in Salem breached by armed insurrectionists defying COVID restrictions. And these are still issues that divide our country going into the 2022 midterms. And so today we're going to be looking at the question is, could Trump's election deniers overturn the 2024 election? And I've covered this in many different ways. I'm going to be doing it in another way. So we're going to look really at how Trump's candidates are doing. He's had quite a war chest that he accumulated, actually raising money off of the insurrection. I think he raised over $150 million off of that. He's also raised quite a bit recently off of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago. And he's used that money to basically fund candidates and to endorse candidates who are loyal to him, right? And so, and one of the ways that they express their loyalty is by believing and running on the belief that that the election, the 2022 election, was stolen. And of course, that's not true, but that's what they're running on, and it has a lot of traction. And so, you know, across battleground states that were actually decisive in Biden's 2020 win, candidates, Republican candidates, have been denying the legitimacy of the election, and nearly two-thirds of the GOP nominations for state and federal offices with authority over elections the candidates are election deniers, and so that was according to a recent Washington Post analysis. So on this show, American Standoff, we examine these connections between seemingly disparate events, like the this issue of election denial and its origins in white supremacy, the DNA of colonialism, and the ongoing occupation of indigenous homelands by this colonial entity called the United States. And so my name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am your host, and this is a call-in show, so please do feel free to call in. The number is 503-231-8187. What do you think of the of these election deniers, and what role could they play in the election 2024? And so I always like to start the show off by introducing myself in my own language. My name is Jacqueline Keeler. And then in the Navajo way, we also introduce ourselves to our clans. My clan is Kia'ani, Towering House Clan, Kia'ani Nishmeh. And I am born for my father's people are the Yankton Sioux or Ihangtawan Dakota people. And my parents were from two different tribes. And so I am actually enrolled a citizen of the Navajo Nation. And they had to choose one. Their respective tribes didn't allow dual enrollment. And so I'd also like to acknowledge that what we now call Portland, Oregon, is located on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Calamet, Clackamas, Kalix bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kaiapuya, Malala, and many other tribes. And of course, the question I like to ask every episode, and one that I'd like for my listeners to think about, is what have we learned about America in the year that has passed since the January 6, 2021 insurrection? And how has that changed your relationship to the idea of being an American? It's a different take on that question, but that's really what I'm going to at the heart at. We'll open this episode with a piece about Christina Caramo. She is the Republican nominee for Michigan's Secretary of State and one of the many candidates Trump endorsed and who won their primary. And she has been making a lot of really crazy claims, including describing, I'll let her describe it. It's pretty crazy. So let's listen to her take on satanic practices.
My audio is not working.
It's not working?
Yeah, I don't know what to do. I'm going to try to figure it out.
Okay. Yeah. That's one with Christina Caramo. It's the first one.
Yeah, I clicked on it, but it's not working. Let me check it out.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Okay, all right. So that audio is just sort of a teaser to kind of get you aware of, like, just about some of the really extreme positions that these folks hold. And it's... it's pretty scary. One of the things that I guess I'll read to you some of the text. So she is running, Christina Caramo is running for Secretary of State of Michigan, which of course she would be overseeing elections in Michigan. And she had a podcast where she discussed mostly religious topics, including her belief that abortion is basically a child sacrifice to Satan. And so, yeah, and it gets crazier. CNN senior editor Andrew Kaczynski went through a lot of these different podcasts and picked out some of the interesting audio from that of things that she said. So not only is she believing the big lie, which is that the election is stolen, but she does believe in demonic possession, and that demonic possession is real and it is transferred via intimate relationships between people. And so I was just going to play some of that audio. And so just to give you a sense of just how some of these candidates are just not the normal types of candidates you would expect. And if you have to think, if a candidate is publicly running on a platform that includes demonic possession, what does that mean for your election, for your vote? How safe is it? And so let's hope the other audio works out. I thought they were, I went and listened to each of them before I emailed them to you. But okay, we'll take a look now. So, so that was some pretty interesting, it's crazy to hear her actually say it too, which is even scarier. And if that wasn't enough to raise your concern about the state of our elections and who's running them, let's listen to some coverage from last week by PBS NewsHour. They covered election deniers are winning primary races, raising the stakes for November's midterms. So let's listen to the audio now.
It's the system. I can't get it to work.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'll keep trying, but I'll let you know when it's on.
Okay. Let me see if I can play it here.
The files are probably fine, but I just can't seem to get it running out of the system.
Okay. Let me try playing it on my end and tell me what the sound is like.
Oh, yeah, you can do that. Yeah, I'm getting nothing.
Oh, you can't hear that?
No.
Oh gosh. Okay. All right. So I was playing that. All right. Okay. This is going to make it a little harder to go through all the material here. So we'll hopefully maybe let me try sending this to you again, and maybe it will work. I think I can just.
Yeah, I'm still not getting anything.
Okay. They are working on my end. I can hear them when I click on them. So, all right. Well, let's go ahead and I guess I'll just go over the article with you. This PBS News piece from last week looked at the reporting done by Amy Gardner from the Washington Post and interviewed her about it. And the title of her article was Election Deniers March Toward Power in Key to 2024 Battlegrounds, and that the GOP nominees who dispute the 2020 results could be positioned to play a critical role in the next presidential election. And the findings are pretty concerning. She focuses on a few candidates in particular, of course, Christina Caramo, who I just mentioned, in Michigan, And then, so she is running, she's now the Republican Party pick to be the Michigan's top election official, who, and she is a election denier. And then Doug Mastriano, he is from Pennsylvania, and he has urged his colleagues to throw out Joe Biden's 2020 victory. And in May, he secured the GOP nomination for governor, a position with the power to certify the state slate of presidential electors. And then we also have another concerning development is that finally this month, Arizona Republicans nominated Kari Lake for governor and Mark Finchem for secretary of state. And both are outspoken election deniers who have pledged that they would not have certified Biden's victory in their state. And I think in the interview, in the PBS interview, Amy Gardner describes sort of that, you know, privately off the record, many Republicans tell her that they don't believe this, but they have to say these things. It's basically a litmus test to even get even to be in the Republican Party at this point, is I believe how she described it. And so these are particularly concerning because they focus on the six battleground states that decided the 2020 vote. And I think there's Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And so looking at of course in Arizona you have the governor and the secretary of state and the attorney general, and who have all questioned the 2020 results, the GOP nominees, I should say, and the U.S. for Senate. So it's all the major offices, just lieutenant governors missing there. I'm going to be doing much more coverage of Arizona situation because, of course, my own, the Navajo Nation is largely located within the, Arizona, and so what happens there deeply impacts my own home communities. And it does seem like they are really Kari Lake, the Republican nominee for governor, is really focused on suppressing votes and particularly imposing sort of voter restrictions that would impact the Navajo Nation and Navajo voters and Native voters in general in Arizona. And Arizona has a very large Native population. And so, so you have Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And so that is, these are all states that, of course, Arizona had Rusty Bowers, who refused to decertify the results. Georgia, of course, had Brad Raffensperger, who also refused to cave to Trump's pressure, but luckily, the governor Republican governor running, is not a denier, election denier. Neither is a secretary of state in Georgia, although the lieutenant governor is, and so and one of the senators is as well. So the Michigan, Nevada, of course, Michigan, we just discussed Caramo, the nominee there, and Nevada. And so all of these states, which were decisive for Biden's win, I think that Gardner was saying that three of them could possibly fall to election deniers, which would be enough of a margin to have denied Biden his win, the number of electoral votes. I think she said they had like 250 between them. And so in her article, she notes, had these candidates, the ones that are running now, and won the nomination, the Republican nomination for these positions in these six states, had they held power in 2020, they would have had the electoral clout to try something that the current office holders refused, overturning the vote and denying Biden the presidency. So the 2024 election is quite scary what could happen, honestly. And she's quoting Finchem, who's won the nomination for Secretary of State of Arizona, and he sent his supporters an email saying, "We would have won, plain and simple." And, you know, the coverage I've done about Arizona in particular, I focused on the role the Native vote plays in really being the decisive vote, being the vote that, you know, puts its thumb on the scale and makes the decision in these even in these red states, which tend to be divided between Democratic and Republican, urban versus rural. And so the native vote is usually these big blue islands in the middle of these red states. And so it does tend, if the difference is small enough, it can be the decisive vote. In the case of like Senator Sinema, which I wrote about, and of course she turned out to be a bit of a disappointment, but she was down by about 35,000 votes, and that was enough for the native vote to make that difference. And I estimated there was about 88,000 votes coming from the Navajo Nation in the northeastern part of Arizona. And So this is quite dangerous, and it's not going away, this big lie and how it's playing out. She quotes here from Richard Pildes, a constitutional law professor at New York University. It could easily lead to a situation where a significant portion of the electorate in these states will never believe the election was legitimate, even if the courts step in and ensure that the lawfully elected winner is in fact certified as the winner. So he says the situation would be destabilizing. So this is a great threat to our democracy. It's a threat to the stability of our country. The article also notes that the predilection among Republican primary voters towards candidates who deny the result of the last election extends well beyond Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Arizona, three states that together accounted for 47 electoral votes in 2020, more than enough to flip the last election to Donald Trump. So, electoral balance, votes in the balance. In the 41 states that have held nominating contests this year, more than half the GOP winners so far, about 250 candidates and 469 contests, have embraced Trump's false claims about his defeat 2 years ago. And so it's quite bad. And the proportion of election-denying nominees is even higher in the six critical battlegrounds that ultimately decided the 2020 presidential contest, where Trump most fiercely contested the results. So those are those six states: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And at least 54 winners out of 87 contests, more than 62% of nominees, have embraced the former president's false claims. So in these very these battleground states, the level of denialism and the success of that, running on that denial, is very high. It's 62%, which is higher than the rest of the country, where it's about half. And so these are all offices with direct supervision over election certification, such as secretaries of state, and which have the power to finalize or contest electoral college count. And this also would include lieutenant governors and attorneys general. It's quite concerning. This is sort of what I think she went through in that interview. And also this Carrie Lake, Republican nominee for governor of Arizona, she is quoted as saying, "Anybody who was involved in that corrupt, shady, shoddy election of 2020, lock them up." So she actually wants, this was from a rally with Trump in January, and so she supports imprisoning people who certified the vote. I guess that would include Rusty Bowers, the former state legislator there. Some of them are not doing well, like Mastriano. He's significantly behind, but it's unclear how this is going to work out, actually. She does quote Rusty Bowers from a text. He says that loyalty in the Republican Party in Arizona to Trump's stolen election claims, he describes them in three words: anger over reason. Mastriano, he made his intentions very clear. He was quoted as saying, "I get to appoint the Secretary of State who's elected who's delegated from me the power to make the corrections to elections, the voting logs and everything. I could certify every machine in the state with the stroke of a pen via the Secretary of State. I already have the Secretary of State picked out. So when they get in power, they are definitely not going to allow the actual votes to be counted. And they plan to use their own claims of election theft to basically conduct election theft. So Mastriano, who is the gubernatorial candidate, Republican candidate, he actually, in Pennsylvania, he actually did attend the January 6th riot at the Capitol. He attended the Capitol insurrection and was captured on video crossing the police line. So he appeared before the January 6th committee this past month, but refused to answer questions. So this is the Republican Party's nominee for governor of Pennsylvania. Yeah. So they went through a lot of this stuff. It's just absolutely astounding. And this is what we're facing right now. Definitely call in to the station if you'd like to be part of this conversation, how you feel about these GOP nominees and in these 2020 presidential battleground states. And you can call in. The number here in the studio is 503-231-8187. And are you concerned about what's going to happen, and what do you think we could do about it? I would be really interested in hearing that as well. Let's try an audio and see if it works. In case you forgot what it was like to have Trump in power, let's listen to some local Georgia TV news coverage of Trump's call to Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger from January 2021. Can we play that clip?
I still don't have it working.
Oh, it's still not working?
Yeah, I can't get nothing. Nothing's playing.
Okay. All right. Well, in case you forgot about what happened how Trump, called in and pressured Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of Georgia, to basically find 12,000 votes for him. And or 11,000 votes, and sort of belittled him and tried to just bully him into committing election fraud, right? And he's accustomed to having this kind of power over his subordinates, and he's not afraid to do this. So his willingness to subvert the legal outcome of the election is real. And it's really faced if his slate of candidates win. And he even threatened Raffensperger in the call with criminal consequences, which at the time he was head of the Department of Justice, and so those kinds of threats were not necessarily idle threats. That's quite concerning. And beyond the election, the thing I wanted to discuss quite a bit, and I'm not sure how many of you are aware of this, is the Supreme Court case, which is looming, called Moore v. Harper. So is the audio still not working at all? Can we try this, the TikTok?
Yeah, it's not working. Can you put it up to your phone? Does that work?
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, let me do that really fast. Hold on a second here. Let me see here.
Moore v. Harper, a case that could seriously change the way elections are handled across the country. The bottom line, this case is about independent state legislature theory and gerrymandering. Here's what's going on with this case. The U.S. Supreme Court announced they will take up that case in the next term out of North Carolina. It's called Moore versus Harper. The short version of the case is the North Carolina Supreme Court threw out a newly redrawn district map the court found to be extremely gerrymandered and therefore unlawful under the North Carolina Constitution. North Carolina's lawmakers completely disagreed and appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the justices said, yeah, we're going to hear that case. The North Carolina lawmakers who are bringing the case subscribe to the independent state legislature theory, and really, that's what the justices are going to be deciding on. If the justices side with lawmakers, it would give state legislatures full control to conduct state elections and create election rules with no check on that power from anyone, including the governor or the courts. In the most extreme case, a state legislature unhappy with the outcome of an election could simply declare it tainted, nullify the results, and award state electors to whichever candidate it wanted. Now, I know that all sounds really scary, and there are some terms in there that may be confusing, but I'm going to explain all of those things right now. First, let's discuss this controversial idea called independent state legislature theory. It's actually rooted in the Constitution in two separate places. In Article 1, Section 4, the Constitution says, the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except as to the places of choosing senators. And Article 2, Section 1 says, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. The independent state legislature theory latches on to the number of times the Constitution mentions the word legislature. Those in favor of the theory believe the Constitution does not use the word court. It does not use the word governor when it comes to elections. It uses the word legislature. Therefore, those who subscribe to the theory believe neither the governor nor the courts should have any say in the legislature's decision. The other word that may be confusing in all of this is the word gerrymander. In this country, every 10 years after a census, congressional district maps are redrawn by state legislatures, governors, and local commissions to better represent the population. And because we just had a census in 2020, those maps have just recently been redrawn. But those maps can really be manipulated for one party's political gain over another. And that process is called gerrymandering. And according to the Supreme Court, it's technically legal, and I'm going to show you right now how it works. Let's take an imaginary state, and in our imaginary state, we have the imaginary Orange Party and the imaginary Green Party. For argument's sake, we'll say all the people who belong to the Orange Party sort of live in the same area, and all the people who belong to the Green Party sort of live in the same area. Now, according to our founding fathers, representation is based on population, and it should be proportional like this. This would be a fair redistricting. You could see the Orange Party, they have more members, they get three representatives, and the Green Party, if I draw the map this way, they also get representatives, even though they have fewer members. But do you want to see how I can gerrymander this map? Boom, like this. You can see if I draw the map horizontally instead of vertically, orange wins every time, meaning only orange representatives. The Green Party, though they still have members, get no representation. It's going to blow your mind. You want to see how I can do it for the Green Party? Like this. See, if you draw the map lines real funny, you can make it so green gets more representatives than orange, even though orange clearly has more members. But you're probably thinking, this doesn't happen in real life. You're damn right it does. These are actual district maps in the United States for the years 2010 to 2020. Some say these are the most egregious cases of gerrymandering in the country. While all of this is happening, the Senate has come up with a bipartisan election reform bill that would address some of those issues I'm talking about, but it has not been put up for a vote yet. Now, whatever the court decides, the U.S. Constitution also requires state legislatures to comply with anti-discrimination law, the Bill of Rights, the 14th Amendment, and all the other federal laws that guarantee voting rights and prohibit any illegal vote counting. The Supreme Court will hear the Moore versus Harper case in the fall.
Okay, I hope that that sound was okay there. I just held it up to my computer. And that was just worth yet. That was a really, thanks for that suggestion. That was really good. So that's a little overview of Moore v. Harper. I know some of the imagery that she was calling up over gerrymandering. You didn't have the images, but I'm sure many of you are already familiar with the concept of gerrymandering and the way in which it really allows politicians to choose their voters, right? And to keep themselves in power. And so with Moore v. Harper, the Supreme Court will decide whether the North Carolina Supreme Court has the power to strike down the legislature's illegally gerrymandered congressional map for violating the North Carolina Constitution, right? And so what the legislators are arguing is that they're arguing for a debunked interpretation of the U.S. Constitution known as the, quote, independent state legislature theory, right, which renders state courts and the state constitution powerless in matters relating to federal elections, right? And so let's listen to some, I'm going to actually play for you something of what's going on sort of
from one of the attorneys that's been litigating this in North Carolina, and she can kind of explain what's been going on there and the fight they've had to deal with this. I think it's really important to hear those sorts of details. This is Allison Riggs. She's co-executive director and chief counsel for voting rights with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. She is also lead counsel representing Common Cause plaintiffs in this case. So let's play that so I can find the right here.
And in fact, for decades, redistricting has been deeply problematic here in North Carolina. Last decade, the legislature enacted extreme racial gerrymanders, packing Black voters into as few districts as possible, almost with surgical precision. And then we won in a court. Court said, no, you can't pack voters based on the color of their skin. And so legislative leaders in the North Carolina General Assembly said, all right, well, if you won't let us racially gerrymander, then we're going to partisan gerrymander. And they were unapologetic about it. David Lewis, who was the chair of the House Redistricting Committee back when we had 13 congressional districts, said, I'm going to draw a map that elects 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, because that's what they did under their racially gerrymandered map. And he said, if it were possible for me to draw a map that elected 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats, I would. It's just not possible. Now, you'll note a problem with this language, right? They're not talking about voters picking who is going to be representing them. They're talking about the politicians picking the voters in the district. We sued in federal court. We said this is such extreme partisan gerrymandering that it violates the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. We won that case in front of a bipartisan panel of judges in Greensboro. We won big time. They said this is outrageous. They weren't even pretending to be fair. And that got appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. I was honored to argue that case in Soe v. Common Cause in 2019, and sadly, on a 5-4 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court said, this is politics. It's not a place for the federal courts. So don't come to us with your complaints on that. The federal courts can't do anything about this. It was a 5-4 decision with Chief Justice Roberts writing for the majority. Chief Justice Roberts, writing on behalf of that majority, said, don't worry, we're not endorsing partisan gerrymandering. This is offensive. This is not how democracy is supposed to work. But we don't want the federal courts to get involved. Go to the states. State constitutions will have provisions, and he pointed specifically to the Fair District Florida amendments in Florida. State constitutions will have more protections, and state courts can enforce those. So don't worry, there's options for you. We took him at his word. Okay, we'll go to state courts. We've got provisions in our North Carolina Constitution that aren't present in the federal Constitution. We have a free elections clause. We will, if there's more partisan gerrymandering, we'll follow that advice. We did that. We litigated this case on an incredibly expedited manner. We won in front of the North Carolina Supreme Court. The North Carolina Supreme Court said 4 different North Carolina constitutional provisions prohibit extreme partisan gerrymandering. Huge win. So we got the congressional maps overturned, the state house maps overturned, and the state senate maps overturned for being extreme partisan gerrymanders. That should have been the end of the story. But Republican leaders in the North Carolina General Assembly said, oh, wait a second, let's revive an argument that came up in Bush v. Gore in 2000, which is, federal courts shouldn't have anything to do with state laws and state legislative action on federal election laws. And so the Republicans in the North Carolina General Assembly appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court first on an emergency basis and then in a more formal basis and said, there's this provision of the U.S. Constitution called the Elections Clause that says the federal government is giving to the state legislatures the authority to set the time, place, and manner of federal elections unless Congress wants to intervene. Congress can do it too, but we're giving it to the state legislatures. There's this radical now interpretation, because no one bought it, not very many people bought this back in 2000, and it sort of died off for a while, but there's this radical interpretation that it means that the framers, when they said we're giving this to the state legislature, meant only the state legislature, which means that that there's no judicial review. Courts can't review when state legislatures make laws, either about congressional districts or any kind of election laws around federal elections. That's silly. It's radical, because state legislatures only exist because state constitutions created them. And in fact, all of the evidence is that the framers knew and were suspicious of state legislatures running amok. They recognized the importance of the system of checks and balances that tripartite government creates. And by tripartite government, I mean you have an executive branch, a legislative branch, and a judicial branch, and each of them balances each other out. So this independent state legislature theory, which the North Carolina is asking the Supreme Court to upset 230 some years of settled law and practice, is what the court is going to be considering in December.
Okay. So there you heard the attorney representing Common Cause in North Carolina, Allison Riggs, and sort of what's been happening as they've been pursuing this in the courts. And I should note that the gerrymander that she's discussing was so extreme that in an evenly divided popular vote, it would have awarded 10 of the 14 seats to the Republicans and only 4 to Democrats. And the map was a radical statistical outlier, more favorable to Republicans than 99.9999% of all possible maps. And of course, they're using computers to create the most crazy gerrymander. The word gerrymander, many of you may already know this, but it comes from sort of salamander, because early on, in the early 18th century, in the late 18th century or early 19th century, this was already happening, and one of the districts looked like a salamander. And I think the folks who had put it together, his name was Jerry or something, so they called it gerrymander. I think that's off the top of my head, but you can look for that. So this is extreme gerrymandering, and it's basically another form of sort of it's very, I had mentioned reading the book about E.B. Du Bois had written about post-Reconstruction South and how, and the way in which these Southern state legislatures basically took back power and disenfranchised Black voters, and this is basically another version of that happening now in the 21st century, and so it's quite alarming, because if they can draw maps like this. This means that no matter how many Democrats there are and how many voters of color there are, they will never be heard. And I have written about this type of voter suppression on a smaller scale in San Juan County, Utah, which I'd mentioned before on this show many times. But it's the same thing happened there. That's the county where Bears Ears National Monument is. And the county is over 50% Navajo, even though it's off the reservation. And so, but they had basically put
Well, part of it is the reservation, most of it isn't. But they had basically put all the Navajo voters in a single district. Utah county commissions are three, usually have three commissioners, and that's the norm throughout the state. And so the minority, the white minority, particularly the Mormon white minority, which is about 30% of the population, they had basically two county commissioners, and the Navajo voters had one. And so the Navajo Nation's Human Rights Commission, or Civil Rights, they took it to the Supreme. They actually sued under the Voting Rights Act, and they won, and they were able to get the. Get redistricted, and now there are two Navajo commissioners and one non-Navajo one. So, but yeah, this is sort of how this works. So, I wanted to play actually another piece here, looking at I still want to play that crazy opening piece, so you can. Oh, it's so crazy with her talking about. But that's the satanic practices thing. You'll have to look it up yourself. It's completely insane. And so, let's listen to coverage, MSNBC coverage of All In with Chris Hayes. He's covering the Supreme Court case that could upend U.S. elections once again. This Moore v. Harper case.
Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 election was stolen is still at the center of Republican politics, especially at the state level in state primaries. We've seen this play out from state to state. The Republican frontrunner to be the next governor of Arizona, Carrie Lake, last week at a primary debate, she used the big lie to bludgeon her opponent, who is not an election denier.
You called Joe Biden an illegitimate president. What does that mean?
He lost the election and he shouldn't be in the White House. We had a corrupt election. I'd actually like to ask everybody on this stage if they would agree we had a corrupt, stolen election. Raise your hand. I'm not going to play your stunt.
I'm not going to play the stunt, although the stunt sort of happened, right? This is a state level race. The January 6th hearings have shown how much pressure was put on state-level officials to overturn the elections. And the hearings have also shown how officials like Republican Arizona Speaker of the House Rusty Bowers, a fellow Arizona Republican, who resisted that pressure, ended up playing a key role in saving our democracy. But now, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case that could essentially make it easier for rogue state officials to carry out the coup the next time around. Mark Elias is the foremost election lawyer in the country, the founder of Democracy Docket. On this upcoming case, he told the Washington Post Republicans are, quote, learning where the pressure points and vulnerabilities are in our election systems and refining their tactics, and he joins me now. Mark, I have to say that people that I follow who are not people given to hyperbole or panic sound panicked about the fact the court has taken this case. Explain what this case is and why people are so worried about it.
Yeah, so Chris, thanks for having me back. And I am usually among those people who are not panicked by any one case before one court. I always counsel against assuming that any one court decision is going to dramatically change the landscape. But this case is different because this is a case that Republicans are trying to use to advance a fringe theory that has never been adopted before that says that state courts reviewing state statutes and actions of state legislatures cannot apply their own state constitutions. This is a radical, radical idea that we would strip state courts of the ability of protecting voters using their state constitutions.
And just to get some context here, this case emerges out of North Carolina, but we've seen in North Carolina in many states either states have adopted referenda or state ballot initiatives or state constitutional changes that control how the state is going to do things like gerrymandering, say that you can't partisan gerrymander. And what we've seen in state after state, Ohio is a place that you've been litigating that we've put a lot of attention. We've seen in North Carolina. What's happened in state after state is Republicans have basically said, screw you, state law. We're going to maximize our electoral strength through gerrymandering. And again, then what often happens, as happened in North Carolina, I believe, and Ohio and other places, is the state Supreme Court, sometimes dominated by Republicans, comes in and say, you can't do this. That's a violation of the state constitution. Republicans want to make that impossible. Is that right?
Correct. And not just in the redistricting arena. It would be bad enough to say that the North Carolina state courts can't hold the state legislature to the state constitution and drawing congressional districts. It'd be bad enough that were true with the Ohio Supreme Court and the redistricting process there for Congress. But this would affect state courts like Montana that has struck down voter suppression laws in that state under the state constitution, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Minnesota, Michigan. The list goes on and on. What Republicans want to do is take a vital tool out of the toolbox for those people trying to protect democracy. And that tool are the state courts using state law and state constitutions to hold their state legislatures accountable to those laws.
We should just be clear about the, I mean, I hope we're spelling this out clearly because it could be a little complex, but just to give an example here, I mean, what's so dangerous about this is if the state legislature draws its own districts, and it draws it in such a way that, say, a Republican Party can get 57% of the seats with 45% of the votes, then they've used this kind of anti-democratic means to kind of barricade themselves in power. And then if the Supreme Court comes along and says, sorry, those guys are essentially unreviewable, they can do whatever they want, you're in a pretty, like, a vice grip of minority rule then.
Right. And Chris, remember, it was only in 2019 that the U.S. Supreme Court said you cannot challenge a partisan gerrymandered map in federal court. Okay, there's no way to challenge partisan gerrymandering in federal court. That was a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court. But Chief Justice Roberts said in that opinion, don't worry, you're going to be able to go to your state courts, and some state courts will allow you to pursue partisan gerrymandering claims that will protect you from extreme partisan gerrymandering. Well, that's North Carolina. North Carolina's state Supreme Court said, we're going to protect the citizens of North Carolina from this extreme form of partisan gerrymandering using our state constitution, because that's what Chief Justice Roberts told us to do. And yet now we're back before the U.S. Supreme Court on whether the state Supreme Court of North Carolina can use the state constitution to protect the voter.
And to connect it back to what we saw in 2020, there's two connections here. One is that the fringiest version of this theory put forward by John Eastman, who's now facing, you know, possible criminal investigation, is that state legislators can basically do whatever they want. They have what he says plenary power, absolute power, to basically say, yoink from the voters who just elected Joe Biden in the state, no, we're not doing that. And then the kind of softer version of that was the Josh Hawleys and the Ted Cruz's, who sort of dressed up the coup in this fringe theory that said, well, state legislators and state courts particularly made all kinds of changes to the time, place, and manner the elections were had because of COVID. That's illegitimate. We want to strike the votes. But those were arguments on the fringe of coup and insurrection that are pretty related to what the plaintiffs are trying to do here.
Yeah. So as you know, Chris, and much of your audience knows, I was involved in litigating more than 60 cases against Donald Trump and his allies in the post-2020 period. And this independent state legislature theory came up time and time again, and court after court, Democratic appointees, Republican appointees said nonsense. This is the single most important doctrine for the Trump Republicans to advance. This is at the heart of what John Eastman and Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump's other band of misfit lawyers tried to advance. And we won't be so lucky next time if they're able to use this doctrine to strip from state courts the ability to hold their legislatures in check.
Okay. So that was a rather long, I apologize, it was rather long, but I think it was really important to go over that particular aspect of what's going on. I'm sorry, I think I would love to have, that was Mark Elias. He's one of the, he's the founder of Democracy Docket and an attorney who has litigated a lot of these cases. I think as you hear, he's concerned as well. And so what exactly this means, I think it's quite troubling. I would love to hear from my listeners What do you think? Do you think this is as scary as it sounds, or how do you think that that U.S. democracy will survive the 2020 the present midterms and then going into 2024? The number here in the studio is 503-231-8187. And yeah, it's pretty very very concerning. So we are definitely looking at a really a great threat with the Supreme Court case. It actually comes down to they believe Amy Coney Barrett. She hasn't said yet which way she's going to vote exactly. This is. Case has been described as the greatest threat to American democracy since the January 6th attack that was in Vox News, and the idea that they're basically trying to Republican legislators in North Carolina are trying to set precedent that would strike down any. Sort of what we all learned about in civics class in high school, which is, you know, the balance of powers of this sort of, I think one of the attorneys called tripartite, I think is the term, where you have, these three different bodies, the executive, the legislature, and the judicial, but weighing against each other and maintaining stability. And so often you hear about Republican or particularly conservative justices in the Supreme Court who support the sort of originalist language, right? Getting back to what they originally meant in the 18th century, right? When they were all stuck inside, Liberty Hall in Philadelphia, you know, sweltering under heat, trying to put these things together, that we have to go back to that, right? And of course, we heard Justice Alito say that, deny Roe v. Wade, basically striking down the right of women to have bodily autonomy and privacy, because that was written by these white guys in the 18th century, right? But that is just it's almost like a religion to a certain segment of the Supreme Court. So it's pretty scary. I think it's pretty clear that Amy Coney Barrett. So right now, four justices, Gorsuch, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Brett Kavanaugh, have all endorsed some version of this independent state legislature doctrine, right? And then meanwhile, the three liberal justices plus Chief Justice John Roberts have signaled they will not overrule the court's many precedents rejecting this doctrine. And so right now it just leaves Justice Amy Coney Barrett, a Trump appointee who typically votes with Republicans in election cases, for her to make the decision. And so I think that we are going to, not going to be, I hate to say it, but we won't know till December, which will be after the primaries, actually after the midterms, and so in the fall. So we're still waiting to see what the fallout's going to be. And it actually appeared, this was part of the court's shadow docket, which is where a lot of these sort of all of these things are coming out from the shadow docket, which are having a huge impact on our lives and on our elections, our democracy, the rule of law, and the direction the court is taking does seem to be sort of helping sort of a mafioso type, authoritarian top-down structure that Trump has enjoyed in his private business life, which he is very successfully porting that over to our political reality, and so it's quite concerning. I definitely want to look more at this, the election reform legislation that was discussed as a possible solution to what's going on here. and to see where that's at and what kind of support it has in Congress and in the Senate. And so I will definitely look at that more in another one. I had promised to do an episode looking at the issue of which has been driving a lot of this rhetoric, is the whole idea of the Great Replacement Theory as well. So I might look at that in the next episode. And there is really concerning news coming out about white nationalism being fueled by social media and attracting violent young white men. I don't know if you saw the reporting in the in Rolling Stone recently that looked at a really radical candidate that we have running right now for governor, and the funding that she's been receiving from Phil Knight. Johnson. She's the independent candidate nominee, and just, you know, the language in there. I would definitely recommend that Rolling Stone article, which is written actually by a really great local writer and reporter, Tim Dickinson, and definitely check that out. So we're coming down to the last minute here. I'd like to thank you all for listening. Please do feel free to call in. I'd love to have a conversation about these things. I know they're not the most lovely topics, but they're really important, and I hope that some of this helps you make a decision about what you could do about it. All right, thank you so much. Hagona, this is Jacqueline Keeler with American Standoff.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 10:59 a.m.